Hi, and welcome back to the Innovation Exchange podcast with me, your host, Dr. Hassan Jahan. In this episode, we're going to be focusing on cardiovascular health. Clot-busting drugs and stents have transformed heart attack and stroke survival rate, with primary prevention such as tighter blood pressure control and medicines like statins preventing thousands more every year. We've got surgical techniques that have been pioneered in the NHS, and they've moved us forward with the treatment of these conditions, but heart and circulatory diseases are still responsible for a quarter of all deaths in the UK. Today, I'm here at the busy Oxford AHSN offices to meet Professor Gary Ford, who's a consultant stroke physician, professor of stroke medicine, and the chief executive of Oxford AHSN. Gary, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, Gary, I thought we'd kick off by you perhaps just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in this field.
Yep. So, I've been a stroke physician for some years, started in the very early days in the 1990s, and have been involved in introducing many of the innovations in stroke care we've seen in the last 25 years with other colleagues across the country.
So I guess my first question to you is, with the wealth of experience behind you, what do you think are our key challenges towards improved cardiovascular health?
So undoubtedly the best thing to do is to prevent a stroke or heart attack happening in the first place. So it's really important we focus on identifying risk factors for stroke and myocardial infarction. These are well known: high blood pressure, elevated lipids, smoking, helping people stop smoking, general lifestyle factors such as physical activity and diet, and in the case of stroke, identifying atrial fibrillation. And we've seen improvements, but there's still a lot of opportunities left, particularly in the better treatment of high blood pressure and of lowering lipids. But even when we improve and optimize our treatment, people will still experience heart attacks and stroke. And when they do, it's important we give the best acute treatment to reduce the likelihood of long-term disability, which is hugely burdensome on people and their families, and also expensive in terms of health and social services. There are some interesting developments in innovation with robotics. We've been involved in some of the trials of that, which can help patients direct some of their own therapy and reduce the demands on therapist time. And then there's a whole range of more social care interventions about how we reintegrate people back into the community so they and their families have meaningful lives. So it's important not to focus just on one part of the pathway, but to think when you're planning a service and you're looking at what are the needs, where can innovation add value, to think all the way across that pathway.
So do you think perhaps we could focus a little bit on prevention first? Why is it that our improval rates are worse than any other European country?
And I think one of the key things is empowering people to take responsibility for their own health and power over their own health and their treatment. And I think we've made improvements in that regard. The areas of where we are lagging behind differ. If you look at atrial fibrillation now, we actually, with the work that's gone on in the last 5 years, have seen dramatic improvements in our detection and our treatment rates in most parts of the country. There's small pockets of areas, typically areas with social deprivation, where we need to do more work, where it's more challenging. There are other areas where we really haven't done enough work. And I'll give you one example. A small group of people who have very elevated levels of cholesterol due to a genetic cause that is inherited, familial hypercholesterolemia. And if that is found, you can identify families at a much earlier stage, and you can identify children who are going to be at risk of heart disease much later in life, and you can start treatment early, which will have real benefits down the line. But our current detection rate for familial hypercholesterolemia are quite poor because we're not systematically testing for that when we find somebody who has a heart attack in their 40s or 50s, for example. How do we introduce genetic testing into primary care so that people don't have to go to a specialist lipid centre or genetic centre to identify that problem? And then we have the more general challenge of the most of the population who are at risk of cardiovascular disease who don't have familial hypercholesterolemia, but they have elevated cholesterol levels, and they need to have the opportunity to take a statin and take the right dose of statin. And then where that statin doesn't control lipids or it is not tolerated. We have newer drugs coming on, like the PCSK9 inhibitors, which are also very effective as an alternative therapy or additional therapy to control lipids. So lipid management, we think, is one key area going forward with prevention. And then more broadly, which is where working with the integrated care systems and STPs becomes important, is how do we look at that, the broader context of the environment, to enable people to lead a healthy lifestyle more easier.
So it seems in my mind that another buzzword I'm going to throw at you then is self-care, which is again featuring in all in many of the ICS STP plans. And I think that really feeds into what you're saying, isn't it, that people have to start taking more responsibility for their own health.
It is easier with some groups than others, there's no question. If you look at healthy lifestyle, it correlates very strongly with social class, and we know there are groups that need more help. People with learning disability or severe mental health problems have worse cardiovascular outcomes. Their focus has to be on their other health problems, or they have more difficulties in taking on that advice. It needs to be tailored to them. But for example, my son has Down syndrome, and you know, he is aware of what is healthy and not healthy. And I think you know, everybody can be helped to take some responsibility for their own health.
Gary, I'm interested to hear your thoughts about statins. So as you know, it's, I'd say probably after antidepressants, one of the most common drug conversations I'll have in the week with any one patient. And that's always tainted a little bit by the lack of evidence around the use of statins as primary prevention, or stated lack of evidence. But also there are many people out there that just read bad things. And there'll be people listening to this podcast thinking, I'm not touching statins. It gives me muscle cramps and aches. What's your thoughts on the use of statins?
So I start from what the evidence tells us, and there's substantial trial evidence on use of statins, particularly in people that elevated cardiovascular risk, which is the population we want to target. There's absolutely no question that statins reduce substantially the risk of both heart attack and stroke, ischemic stroke, and reduce the risk of overall mortality. What has happened is there is a lot of concern in the media, which is picked up, which is based on some facts, but has been exaggerated. But of course, people get muscle pains all the time. And so it is natural, if you start a statin, you get a muscle pain, you're going to attribute it to the statin. So one has to have a conversation fully informing people that this is a potential problem, but explaining the key benefits if you don't get those problems. The key issue, though, with statins is that most people are not taking the optimal dose. We now know that the higher dose intensity of statin is much more effective than the lower doses that used to be prescribed many years ago. So one of the things we're looking at is how do we identify people who are on a statin but actually would gain much more benefit from having a more intensive dose of statin given.
So Gary, let's move off prevention and talk about treatment now. Many people probably are now quite familiar with the concept of clot-busting drugs. So interesting to get your take on the effectiveness of them and going forwards, really, what's next? What's out there?
So clot-busting drugs in stroke absolutely transform the way we plan stroke services and also the outcomes of patients. The general view, because they reduce disability in the short term and because disability is a strong predictor of subsequent mortality risk, clot-busting drugs do increase more survival in stroke patients long term. However, they only work in about a third of people with blocked arteries. So innovators and researchers have been thinking, how can we improve that effectiveness? And what has happened is we've gone the route of the cardiologists, and the way to open more arteries up is you get a catheter into the vessel and you put a removable stent in and you pull the clot out. So that is the technique of thrombectomy. It opens up arteries in 75 to 80% of cases. But the problem is we don't have a healthcare system in the UK that has been set up to deliver it. And we have a situation, for example, in Scotland where there is no thrombectomy service in the whole of Scotland. In England, we have currently three centres that offer 24/7 thrombectomy. Every minute of delay increases the likelihood of disability with this treatment. Some countries are putting CT scanners into ambulances and taking them out to image people, you know, on the street in the back of an ambulance. But another approach is there a blood biomarker? You can do a test in the community to work out who's got a stroke. And there's some interesting work evolving at an early stage. We're involved with spin-out company from Warwick, which looks at purines are released. We're looking whether that can identify people early and bypass a local hospital if they're likely to have a stroke amenable to thrombectomy and take them to the thrombectomy centre. There's a lot of things we need to fix in the system. Another challenge is the scans of the blood vessels are hard to interpret. A lot of hospitals have out-of-hours contracted services, which would be slow to interpret those. So there is the possibility of using machine learning, artificial intelligence, to diagnose these scans automatically, which would not be the equivalent to a neuroradiologist reporting it, but would be good enough in terms of its accuracy to make a decision to transfer somebody.
So it sounds like there's lots of challenges there, particularly for implementing something like a thrombectomy. And it's interesting to hear that the challenges you mention in terms of where innovation is needed aren't necessarily around technology or kit. It's about logistics, isn't it? So I guess when I hear about something like that, I think, actually, yeah, that's a great idea. Why can't we get scanning in ambulances? But, you know, maybe that's where we should be looking to innovate.
I think my own view is that the solution to delivering thrombectomy to patients is not going to be scans in the back of ambulances, because there are, even if you did that, there are quite significant logistical challenges in for remote areas. But more importantly, you still got to get the patient to the thrombectomy centre. So I'm more of the philosophy that scoop and run with stroke, as soon as you know they've got a stroke, is probably the more productive approach.
And what role do you think robotics have to play in this sort of intervention, or other interventions relating to perhaps stroke medicine?
So the very interesting area of work which is starting to come out, it's an early stage, is can we use robotics for therapy in people? We can clearly see the potential advantage of that.
This may be a bit too sci-fi, but are you aware of the use of robotics in something like mechanical thrombectomy? So, you know, when a few years ago nanorobots were the big craze and that's what's going to transform medicine, you're going to stick these things in and they're going to go and fix everything. Is that something that you're aware of that's being worked up, or something that's even possible?
I'm not aware of the idea of a pure robotic operator, but I think the whole idea of introducing technology, pressure sensors, better understanding of where the catheter is in a complex circulation is definitely there and being developed.
I might just touch on rehabilitation for a minute then. What really are the key things that we should be looking to do to improve the care for our patients?
The one people are probably most aware of is stem cells. So there's some really interesting work, but it's a very early stage and we don't know if that's going to translate into clinical benefit, but it's going to be at least 10 years before we know the results of the research going on and how that's evolving. But that's a really interesting area which in rehabilitation. The second thing we know is that the focus of rehabilitation is very much around physical disabilities. You know, can we improve arm function? But we know what matters to patients, and there's been quite a lot of work done on this, is much broader issues. Quality of life, social activities, relationships with families, etc. So there are other areas which are being explored, like virtual reality and more general interventions in terms of how do you maximise people's quality of life when they have a level of disability that may not be able to be amended. And that's where, you know, taking a health and social care perspective rather than just a health perspective becomes so important.
What is it that we're missing? So why is it that the outcomes for UK population in terms of cardiovascular mortality is amongst the worst in Europe? But why is that happening? Is it because nobody's paying attention, or is it because the focus has shifted? Is it that we've not got the money despite all the innovators and the interventions? What in your opinion, what's going wrong?
Okay, so I'm not sure I'd accept that data. Okay. So we've got to be a bit careful. So the international comparisons are problematic because they're often not comparing exactly like with like. Some areas we clearly do very well. Access to stroke unit care is amongst the highest in the world, for example. Our thrombolysis treatment rates are okay. They're not as good as Scandinavia, for example, so there is room for improvement there. Thrombectomy treatment rates are frankly abysmal. Prevention, the picture is mixed. Some countries, like Canada, do achieve better control of hypertension. But in other areas like smoking cessation, we're doing pretty well. And as I mentioned earlier, atrial fibrillation, we're doing very well.
Well, I only bring it up because whilst looking at the same data, people were comparing the outcomes for countries like Finland, where they had very bad mortality or outcomes and made massive public health interventions, including green spaces and encouraging people to walk to school and those sorts of interventions that have meant that their cardiovascular outcomes have improved. So I guess there's a lesson for us in terms of public health, as you said, in terms of making more parks, making more open spaces that are safe, but also putting them in the right place. So as you said, with the deprived populations, making sure that they've got access to the right services for improved diet, improved physical exercise, and to try and reduce the problem that is obesity within the UK and the Western world.
There's no doubt the Finland experience, although it was some time ago, shows the real impact you can have on cardiovascular disease is through effective partnership interventions with the community, with local government, and that is, you know, where we have to also put our attention on, as well as the treatments as doctors that we prescribe.
Social prescribing. So earlier this week, Gary, I spoke to a few innovators who've been inspired by these challenges to come up with some of their own interesting solutions. Would it be okay if we listen to some of those conversations now?
Yeah, you're really interesting.
First of all, I caught up with Lawrence Pierce at Zim, who's going to tell us about LifeLite.
Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about LifeLite.
Yes, hi there.
I'm really interested to hear about this from watching the video and having a browse of the website. For starters, do you think you could just tell us a little bit about LifeLite, please?
So in essence, LifeLite is a technology that allows a regular mobile phone, a smartphone, to record somebody's blood pressure, heart rate, respiration, and other vital signs in 30 to 40 seconds simply by looking at the selfie camera. So in other words, it turns a smartphone into a blood pressure monitor.
So Lawrence, this all sounds really, really exciting. I have to say, when I first read about it and looked at it, I thought this is just game changing. But do you think perhaps you could have a go at just explaining the technology to me? I'm just intrigued as to how you can get an accurate blood pressure result from something that is non-contact and is just completely out there in terms of the way we've been measuring blood pressure for years.
Absolutely, yes. It's interesting how blood pressure measurement hasn't really changed in over two centuries, really, fundamentally. LifeLite's technology combines two areas of science. Firstly, remote PPG, which is the ability to detect blood volume pulse from somebody's face. So we're looking, if you like, at a micro blush. Every time your pulse beats, your face changes colour in a very tiny amount, about 2% of the colour. So modern cameras on smartphones can actually detect that level of detail. And then 30 frames a second, we turn that into a waveform. Then the second part of our innovation is deriving blood pressure from these PPG waveforms. So looking at the shape of the waveform and from that calculating systolic and diastolic blood pressure. So interesting and complex science to create something as simple as looking into the phone to measure your blood pressure.
Thanks for explaining that, Lawrence. And so it looks as though, according to the website, this is up and running. Is that true? I mean, what sort of stage are you at in terms of development of LifeLite?
So LifeLite, from a regulatory perspective, is being used first by professional users. And so we're piloting in primary care with East Devon Federation. There are 13 practices who are testing LifeLite as patients arrive for appointments, measuring their blood pressure in the wait area. They're also using it during consultations to save time. LifeLite takes 40 seconds, whereas a traditional blood pressure reading can take 3 to 4 minutes. They're also looking at using it in minor injuries to help triage people on arrival. So as well as primary care, we've got two mental health pilots. One is Essex Partnership Trust and the other is Northeast London Foundation Trust. And they're looking at they're using the contactless aspect of Lifelight for patients with severe dementia, psychosis, who find who refuse to have physical observations taken, basically refuse having a cuff put onto their arm.
Lawrence, can I ask you about validity of some of this stuff, though? So how can we be assured that, you know, actually these results stand true and they're pretty accurate?
So the Portsmouth study has allowed us to measure and map 8,500 people, measured twice. So we have 1 million heartbeats recorded in a database, and that's been the basis of our algorithm development. We've then done a separate validation study with another 150 volunteers to take the finished algorithms and measure them against standard of care. And so that's from that work, we've been able to achieve a level approximately the same accuracy and reliability that you'd get from a fairly basic automated cuff. Our goal is simply to produce something that's clinically useful.
So have we got a cohort of individuals that this would be more useful for? So is it aimed at the well everyday user who wants to just get an idea of what their blood pressure range might be, or is it more for the known hypertensive patient who's looking for regular monitoring, or is it both?
It's I think it's both ultimately. So our goal is to get this for, as you say, for home users. What we're interested in is making something that's really frictionless for people who are hypertensive or maybe don't know that they're hypertensive. The kind of people who wouldn't be bothered to buy a cuff, fit a cuff every morning, take a measurement, check their blood pressure. We want to make it as easy as looking at Facebook or Instagram.
And we talked earlier on about the Mental Health Trust using this for dementia patients. What do you see as the future applications of this technology, Lawrence?
So we really see that as one of the early use cases. So what we wanted to do is get this in use, as opposed to being an interesting project. If you go out and test it in a challenging environment, like an acute mentally ill ward where we're testing, you get to use this device. You're using the software on an iPad in an environment with patients who can be quite confused, distressed, and staff who understandably are very busy. It's a really good real-world test.
That's excellent. Like I've said several times, this sounds like really exciting technology. I think what you're facing probably is just the fact that people have been testing blood pressure the same way for, as you said, centuries, and really about identifying the perfect or the right cohort of individuals for application, I guess.
Absolutely, yes.
So what are the next steps for you as an individual with innovation?
I'd like to see Lifelight moving beyond the NHS. We've got some fantastic support and traction at all levels of the NHS now, which is wonderful. But my real vision for this is to see, for example, the 600 million smartphone users in India who have limited access to healthcare being able to benefit from a technology like this, being able to send your vital signs as part of, say, a Skype GP consultation can be massively useful, as you would know, of course, Hassan.
Completely agree, and I think this really is going to change the way we allow patients to access healthcare advice, but also for purposes of monitoring and self-care. I think this really will help.
Absolutely. I think the one thing that the not only the NHS but health systems globally need right now are ways to empower patients to self-manage, become more independent, and to use the system when they critically need it, as opposed to looking to the health system to solve everything for them.
That's a perfect line to finish on. Lawrence, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. This is really an exciting innovation and one that I'm desperate to get access to on my phone myself and see if I can bring it to use within my colleagues in primary care and even across secondary care. Thank you.
Thanks, Hassan. You're very welcome.
So next I spoke to Dr. Katharina Sprunger from Oxford Heartbeat. Hi, is that Katerina?
Yes, it is. Hi.
Katerina, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you for having me. That's a pleasure.
So do you think you could start by telling us a little bit about Oxford Heartbeat?
Yes, of course. So at Oxford Heartbeat, we develop technology that helps with planning of minimally invasive surgeries that involve the deployment of devices called stents inside blood vessels of patients. So we help clinicians to choose the right stent for every individual patient.
Wow. And so is that something that you do via looking at pre-existing imaging, or have you got your own sort of imaging that you're using to try and make that decision?
So we import the patient scans that have been acquired before surgery. It's a routine practice. And then we automatically reconstruct very accurately a 3D blood vessel tree of the patient. And then our software also has a library of digital twins of stents that behave exactly like real devices do. And then in the virtual environment of our software, clinicians can, on the particular patient anatomy, can try out different devices, different stents, different placement positions, different surgical strategies, and then see which one works best for that particular patient. And then they can go into the actual surgery more prepared and then perform the surgeries more safely for a patient.
That sounds fantastic. So in essence, it's a try before you buy sort of approach. So they can upload the arteriograms is it quite easy in terms of just placing a stent in the occluded vessel and just seeing what happens to the flow? Is that basically what we're talking about?
Yes, basically it's exactly what we're talking about. This device, this stent, are very sophisticated. So first of all, if you look at them, they look very simple. They look as if, you know, it's you're looking at the spring of your pen, but actually it's a deceiving impression. They're very complicated mechanically. So first of all, they're made of shape memory self-expanding materials such as nitinol. Then also the mesh of the stent is braided, which means that the same device can be that long or short depending on where you put it in. And because blood vessels of patients are very irregular, it's very hard with traditional methods for clinicians to predict how a particular stent is going to so-called land in that particular segment of the patient's anatomy.
And in terms of, you know, the decisions they're sort of making, are we talking about whether it's, is it principally site or placement, or is it more around long-term success rates?
So it's all those things together. So if you're talking about the brain, for example, our first product is for the brain surgeries where the accuracy is paramount. So half a millimeter would make a huge difference. It could mean a failed or a successful surgery, really.
Right. What sort of stage are you at in terms of development with this, Katerina? Are you looking at various sites or focusing on one particular area?
So we develop our first product for brain. It's called Precise Neurovascular. And so it's a software technology, but from a regulatory point is a medical device, which means that we need to obtain regulatory approvals to launch it. We need a CE marking approval to launch it, for example, in the UK and Europe. So a few weeks ago, we had a huge milestone where we successfully passed our CE marking audit, which is very exciting, which means that from next year, we will be able to deploy this technology in real clinical practice, in prospective clinical practice. It's very exciting that we can actually bring it to the market.
Listening to the way you're talking about this innovation, I can't help but think, surely if we get to a point where we've got the images that can be 3D modeled, and on the other side of it, we've got a variety of stents, we must be getting to a point maybe in the future where actually AI can be used to find the right stent, the right size, etc. for many of our patients. Do you think?
You're absolutely correct. And this is also what we are aiming to do. This is the ultimate goal of this technology. With time, we will be able to really obtain insights that are currently unavailable. So with this technology and going forward and sort of really having some objective measures, we can start seeing patterns of, you know, whether some devices don't behave well and others do behave well in certain situations.
You have a computer telling you actually there is this occlusion, this is the stent they need, and then you can start planning the intervention rather than having to wait.
That's correct. To order a personalized stent for a particular patient takes 8 weeks, and some patients can't wait 8 weeks. So yeah, there is definitely a scope and potential to improve not only the outcomes of these procedures, but also reduce the waiting time for patients.
Okay. Katrina, can I ask a little bit about you? Because you're an engineer by background, is that right?
So I did my undergraduate in computer science, specializing in AI and robotics. So I studied in Germany. Then I worked as an AI researcher at Sony Computer Science Laboratory in Paris. Some relatives got very ill, and then kind of which led to a crisis on my part and sort of re-evaluating everything I do and I want to do. And I decided that I want to dedicate my skills, life, and sweat and blood and energy to doing something very meaningful for patients.
So it sounds like you've been on quite a personal journey taking your engineering skills and bringing them into the healthcare sector. Have you got any tips for people out there who are budding entrepreneurs who want to get involved in innovation within healthcare?
Yeah, sure. I think it's very important if you are an engineer and you want to go into medicine and develop something, it's very important before you start building anything that you think is exciting is to really talk to your end users and clinicians. I try to sort of have conversations and interview as many surgeons that I could possibly get my hands on. And only after months and months, kind of the idea of the product and the concept of the product actually emerged. Because as an engineer, it's very easy to get distracted and build what you think is great, what you think is useful, but it's actually very different from a clinical point of view. So my advice would be work with clinicians from day one.
Useful tips. Thank you, Katrina.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to you about our product because we are very proud of it and we can't wait to see it really make a difference for patients.
Finally, I got to speak to Dr. David Albert, the founder of AliveCor. Let's hear what he had to say.
David, welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So David, I've got a bit of a head start on you here because AliveCor has been available in our practice for quite some time and I've been using it in my doctor's bag for probably coming up to a year now. So I'm fully familiar with it. But how about you tell us a little bit about AliveCor and what got you into it?
Well, I've been, you know, I left academic medicine about 3 decades ago. I'm old. I turned 65 tomorrow, as a matter of fact, Hassan. I was an engineer as well as a medical student at Duke University back in the late 70s and early 80s. And I had already licensed several inventions. And so I told my wife, and we had 2 young kids, I was going to start a company. And she thought I was crazy, as did most of my friends and my parents, but it's worked out for me. So AliveCor is my 4th company, Hassan. And the last one I sold to a little company called General Electric, where I was the chief scientist of GE Cardiology for 3 years. And then back in 2010, I started AliveCor. And, you know, with a fairly simple idea that these new things called smartphones, and in 2010 they were new, were going to revolutionize the access to healthcare. And so I developed the first AliveCor EKG device. And now 8 years on, we're on about our 4th or 5th generation and have sold literally hundreds of thousands all over the world, including a number of several thousand to the National Health Service.
So understandably, David, it's been a big hit over here. I wonder if you wouldn't mind just explaining to those of our listeners out there who haven't actually come across AliveCor yet, if there are any, what actually the device does.
Well, you know, for right around 100 pounds, you get a very small device that can fit into a wallet, very flat, and looks like maybe slightly smaller than a stick of gum that you put your fingers on or compress it to your chest. And then on your smartphone, you see a real-time ECG tracing. If you're holding in your hands, that's lead one, standard lead one. And if you push it on your chest, you're getting a precordial lead. And then after 30 seconds, a minute, it will do an automatic analysis and tell you you're in normal sinus rhythm or potentially atrial fibrillation and allow you to directly transmit that to a doctor, to a nurse, and have an instant professional overread.
It's fantastic. David, I guess I should ask, often we try to inquire about innovations in terms of, you know, whether it's being used in a number of sites and you know, what plans are for further expansion. Clearly, this is already bread and butter investigation choice now across the world. So what's next for AliveCor and for you?
Well, we just recently introduced a brand new product. So our conventional cardiomobile has been around for now, 7 years, but now we introduced the cardiomobile 6L, which gives you half the 12-lead ECG, 6 leads. We sold out in the first week, so I'm getting all kinds of nasty emails from the UK. And I apologize to all our friends because we underestimated the demand. You know, it's really a brand new concept that's only 110 years old. The original EKG machine from Wilhelm Einthoven had each of your hands in a bucket of salt water and your left leg in a bucket of salt water. And that's how it measured what is known as the Einthoven's triangle. And so what we did is we took our little teeny smartphone device, and instead of just having two electrodes on top, we added a third electrode on the bottom such that you can connect it to your ankle or your knee and have Einthoven's triangle. And what it does is it gives us the ability to do many more types of diagnoses. And so we'll be releasing a number of new software innovations in addition to this new hardware that allow doctors to look beyond just atrial fibrillation.
It's just so exciting to think about the applications of many of these innovations out in the community, even because earlier on we spoke to somebody about the use of technology in terms of measuring blood pressure in a non-contact way. And if you've got something like this where you're able to get ECG readings, when you're out and about in somebody's home without having to necessarily have access to a full 12 lead, you're getting to a point where you can start to make diagnoses.
And if I told you in the future, so we've gone from one lead to all 6 limb leads, so half the 12 lead, that maybe we'll enable a self-recording or professional recording of a 12 lead ECG, a full 12 lead with a device no bigger than a stick of gum. Maybe something like that's coming.
Amazing stuff, David. I guess one question I should ask, you touched on it before where you talked about some of your past. So in getting a live core up and running, did you hit any challenges?
There are always challenges. I mean, fortunately, I'm a serial entrepreneur, which meant I had a track record. I had made investors money, but there was still a challenge because when you bring a brand new concept that nobody's done before. And at the time in 2010, people either thought it was useless, it was impossible, or it would never be economically viable. And as any entrepreneur, you have to overcome each barrier thrown up in your way. I may have had some credibility, but I once again had to prove to people that this wasn't a crazy, stupid idea.
There is always skepticism in UK. We wouldn't be British if we weren't skeptical about everything. For all of us out there who actually get some benefit from the device, not least our patients, thank you. It's been fantastic.
Well, thank you. That makes my day every day. As I said, tomorrow is my 65th birthday. And, when somebody comes up and says, you've helped me, you've helped one of my patients, I can tell you, my friend, that makes getting up and working something I want to do every day. So thank you very much.
Well, happy birthday, and thank you, David. All the best.
So it's fascinating to hear some of those innovations. Back to you, Gary. We're seeing, aren't we, more and more innovations that link to doing more and more in a patient's own home or in their own environment, such as patches, such as using devices like a live core for monitoring out in the community. We know that everybody's got a smartphone. We know that if you give somebody access to technology that uses their smartphone, they're more likely to comply and we're more likely to get an outcome from it. I guess there is a question about how far we go in terms of validating these things when there are a raft of mobile phones out there and technologies. But I think something about this is about how we start to standardize the world of apps, and maybe NHS apps is going to be the solution for that.
Yes, I mean, we've seen a proliferation of apps to help advise people, as well as the apps focused on diagnosis, because there's a very low barrier to entry for developing a digital app. We will have to think, though, about how these are used, because what we don't want is to introduce diagnostics where there is no clear evidence for intervening and potentially raising health concerns when it's not going to be very helpful to the individual. But I think that is, you know, something that will be looked at in terms of recommended apps and the like.
Thank you, Gary. I guess last question from me is have you got any advice to these and other innovators out there in terms of how they get into the NHS or help the NHS?
Think really long and hard about what is the need, who is the user who is going to have to pay for this, what is the model of commissioning. For some things it conceptually would make sense to have a single license for the NHS with a single annual fee, and then any clinician in a registered trust or primary care practice could then download and use that. A lot of apps at the moment are sold to a single use, single individual, and that is probably a more challenging model.
So Gary, thank you so much for the fascinating conversation. It's been really interesting to hear your thoughts on some of the innovations out there, but also to hear your thoughts on prevention, treatment and rehabilitation of patients with stroke. It's clear that there are some key challenges out there in the community and within the hospital sector, and I'm hoping through exciting innovations coming forward and changes to commissioning pathways, we can try to transform care for our patients.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.